Welcome to the 75th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel. Three quarters of a century, man.
What's up?
We did it.
Three quarters of a century?
Yep. Feels like we've done this forever. Because it feels like forever.
It feels like it's been 75 years since.
But thanks for coming on this journey with
episode. Yeah. Thanks for waiting it out.
You're still here. If you're listening to this, by definition, you've stayed with us.
And we're still here. Despite ups and downs and the roller coaster of releasing an episode of streaming internet.
Yeah, that's definitely what's kept us away from this. Yeah,
I feel like
we had a lot of tasks to
that's
do.
That's what weighed heavily on me.
Yeah,
and it made me.
Every time we had time, Kalen's like, "No, we're releasing a streaming video show. I have to sit by the internet and watch it."
I mean, I feel like embarrassed, but also comfortable saying, all I did for the last 2 weeks was refresh Twitter.
Do you want to give them a sprinkling of the best and worst Twitter reactions to our episode?
Because
last time we were talking to you, we had just come out with the show. Or it was about to come out.
It hadn't even come out yet.
Great. So, great. We should take 5 minutes and do this. So there has been a cavalcade of curious responses.
Everyone's seen it. Everybody listening to this has seen it by now.
If you haven't seen it, please.
Can I say something before I want to hear you go about on this this cavalcade. But,
yeah, sure.
Is it so self-indulgent to do an episode, not about the show, but that actually does what we're going to do in 5 minutes in a longer way about, like, the experience of putting out an episode? Is that just too...
Yes, is the short answer.
All right.
The longer answer is, happy to do that, I don't think, on this channel.
On this channel?
On this, you know, Does Your Favorite Movie Suck channel. I would say, like, we can...
Where else would we do it?
We'll put it on a different thing.
There'd just be a one-episode podcast?
We'll just put it on YouTube.
I don't know if we want to subject
our normal listeners to this. We have a
Well, it
thing.
Could be a bonus episode.
Yeah, maybe if we label it appropriately.
Let's do this. We've never really tested this before. If you want to hear that episode, let us know.
Yeah, great. Well, while we're on that, we started an Instagram channel, and DYFM Suck. And I did that today because one of our listeners is a visual artist and he's very good. And we're going to release a new original piece of art that he's going to do for every episode we do. It's going to be put up on our Facebook page, which if you don't like that, please like that. And our Instagram page and our Twitter, DYFMSuck on Twitter, DYFMSuck on Instagram. Please follow him. His name is Thomas James.
He's done a piece of art for this very episode,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Wait a minute,
his name is Thomas what? James?
Thomas
James.
Yeah.
I thought for
follow
a moment
him.
That you said Thomas Jane.
No, no, it's different. That's
Tom Jane.
No. No.
The Punisher.
No, not the Punisher.
Would have been very excited.
Thomas
about
James,
that.
At Good Job Tommy. At Good Job Tommy on Instagram. Anyway, check it out. It's cool. It's really cool stuff.
I'm very glad that you're talking about that and introducing Thomas James to our listeners and me and the world. But you were about to say something that I was more interested
in. Hey. Listen, people do nice things for us. We reach out. We support them. They support us. It's lovely.
People like
the show, Kalen. And we like them for liking it. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Listen, I don't want to spend... We've already spent two minutes of this five-minute segment on other things. But there was a...
This segment has never been 5 minutes.
It's going to be 5 minutes. No, I'm saying about
just about our show.
I don't want to spend too much time on it. But we had our first experience at being on the receiving end of praise and sort of vituperative aggression as a result of our episode that we wrote. And it's been hysterical.
We had the thrill, the unparalleled, at least for me, thrill of... having our episode singled out and praised by the likes of National Public Radio and others.
IO9.
IO9. Top of the list.
Number
best
one.
Best of 10.
Best of the 10.
To say nothing of...
Naked Bananas.
That's not what it's called, but that's where I was going.
What's it called? Naked Bananas.
It's not called Naked Bananas. It's called
Cold Bananas?
Yeah, that's it.
Guys, coldbananas.com said we're
don't
the best
don't make fun
episode.
Of it. It was a nice little piece that he wrote up very nicely.
He gave us a 5 banana out of 5 banana review.
Well, I think you're making that up, but he did say that ours was the best. He did say ours was the best episode of the 10.
He does rate out of 5 bananas. I'm not making that
up. Well, it was 4. The show got 4 bananas.
Okay, so you did see it.
The show got 4 bananas.
If we're number one of a 4 banana show, we are a 5 banana episode. That's how banana ratings work, Kalen. You don't average out to a 4 if your number 1 is not a 5 banana. It's mathematically impossible.
You really have a point there. Maybe we're a 6 banana show. I don't know. Overripe, he called it. I don't know how many bananas you can get. Maybe
fully
we'll write and ask.
Yellow.
So all of that was very exciting. We have also had the experience of being very low on certain lists. And the most interesting thing, I'm going to say, for me, the most interesting thing about the entire release was the experience of getting fucking gut kicked with the most scathing review I imagine we may ever get. Now, that's, I think I, it would be hard to imagine an episode somebody hating something.
Hope that that's not the most hatred we ever get, because I really enjoyed the experience of it.
Did you?
I really did. I was thinking about it. I really have enjoyed all of the media process. It hasn't bothered me at all.
I enjoyed it, which we can go a little bit into detail on, although I don't want to go that deep. It's a very, very, very valuable life experience that I didn't have.
Yeah, it has generated... Things are valuable in that they generate thoughts or conversations. That's how I sort of approach things. And the various reviews have created a number of conversations between Kalen and I that I think were awesome and we wouldn't have had otherwise, and certainly informed, at least in the conversational phase, our work going forward. And I think that's awesome and cool. I did not find it bothersome. I found it very interesting. I found it bothersome for a day or two.
Yeah. I went over and over it.
I'm going to let you talk more about that, because one reviewer said it's the single most problematic episode of television he's ever seen.
He said it's the most sneakily offensive episode he's ever seen.
Amazing.
Sneakily.
Yeah. And that bothered you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair. I don't think it's sneakily offensive.
And it bothered me sense that I had to... I'll get to this later, but I sat down with this person.
Does he listen to the show?
Fuck no. Okay, good. Not in a million years.
Just wondering how I can...
this is not on blast, because spoiler alert, he and I actually sat down because he and I know each other in life, and he forgot that he knew me. I remembered. And I invited him out to a drink, and we hung out for like 5 hours. He's great. He's great.
Not a nice fly-by-night reviewer, by the way. Not a cold banana website.
I'm going to tell him who it is. So it's Film Crit Hulk, who is writing for Vulture. You can go look it up. They should go read the review. Ooh. You should go read it, because it's fascinating.
But if you're going to read that, read the cold bananas review, too. Just
read that,
even
too.
Enough.
And, I mean, read the comments under the Film Crit Hulk review, and there are other places that have... One of the things that's interesting about this is a tangent... people have come out to say this guy got this episode so amazingly wrong. Here's why.
Which he did.
And then they sort of defend us without knowing us. I mean, they don't know us. And so some of the comments on there say some of those things. And then I found a really nice comment that said, which is the way I feel, that this guy usually is so educational and instructive and a valuable voice in film criticism. He still is. But in this case, he could not disagree with him more. And then he says why, and says it's a great episode. So these things are out there.
As a precursor to what you're about to say, he was doing each episode one by one and writing what I thought to be extraordinarily helpful, interesting, intelligent,
insightful.
Thoughts about each episode. Yeah. And he'd done 5 or 6. And Kalen and I were both watching that page, being like, I can't wait to see what he says about ours. I think he'll give it this rating. I think he'll have this to say about it. This guy knows what he's talking about. Yeah. This is before he wrote the episode, the review. Yeah. And then he skipped ours. Do you remember this?
He didn't skip it, but they published him slightly.
Okay. So, and then we were like, oh, what does that mean? Does that mean something? And then ours came out. And it was a 1 out of 5-star review, and it made him upset, it seemed.
Yeah. He was really, really put off by the episode. So anyway, so that was a very amazing thing, because it made – the point of this story is not what happened later, although I'll skim over that. But that Travis and I started interacting and exchanging, and it caused us to – it destabilized us so much, because we were like, wait a minute. Like, let's not throw this out of hand. Let's not get mad. Let's use this opportunity to say, did we fuck up? Did we do something that was coded in a certain way, or that used metaphors, or that used ideas, that played with everything wrong? The thing about the review that really upset me and really troubled me was that he claimed to know how we created the episode.
Yeah.
And he sort of implies that it was created out of a lazy or sloppy, emotionally kind of turbulent, you know, feeling or, you know, whatever. And I was like, fuck, is that true? I really was. I was like, that is so – I have a lot of respect for this guy's views and the way he writes. could that be the case? And so we had, that's what really, I was like, I spent like 48 hours thinking about that. And then you and I were sort of texting back and forth, and those 48 hours or so led me to the conclusion that, oh no, that's not at all what we did. And something has gone horribly wrong with the way he's watched this episode. Mm-hmm. That was the conclusion I reached. So I became so obsessed with knowing the answer to that. How could somebody watch something that I believe so much in and get it so different, if not to say wrong, may not be wrong, I don't know, you know, it's up to anybody else. But in my opinion, he watched something that was completely antithetical to what we were creating, that I wanted to sit down with him and ask how that could, what he saw. How did you watch that? Tell me, explain it to me. So I did. So we did. And it was great. Now I know.
Which is?
Well, I don't know if it's cool to just go into a sort of private conversation, but ultimately...
In case he's wrong and we're right.
Yeah, I mean, I came out not feeling like... not feeling persuaded.
I mean, there is something interesting.
Nor did he, by the way. He didn't feel persuaded by me. But,
I feel like this is something that people go through, and I'm happy to be at a point where get to go through this, and I hope it happens again, and, you know, and I hope it continues to happen. But the process of having something... and I don't want to call it art by committee. I think Caitlin and I were really lucky to actually have a fairly singular set of voices on the episode, which a lot of my friends write for television and film, and they don't have as clean of an experience as we had. I mean, I think we were really lucky with the director that we got, and the development process was fairly hands off. The notes we got were actually fairly helpful, and not especially aggressive. And so we got to make something that's very close to what we wanted to make, with some notable exceptions. Whatever, that's just what happened. So. I think that having that experience was really, really awesome. But then to get to have that interact with the population at large and to see what people project on it, think about it, to see the things that we agree with. So there's certain flaws in our episode that we are frustrated by and we didn't have much control over. But people are also frustrated by that. That's cool. There's things that we thought were cool that other people think suck. And that's also cool to see. So it's been really awesome. And I like the idea of film and television as a sort of, you know, inherently collaborative medium, getting to collaborate one more time with an audience and letting them project and imagine how we made it. And what the most interesting thing, there's two points about this. One is where people assumed we started the brainstorm process.
Right.
That's been fascinating. Almost all of them are wrong that I've seen. And the other thing is what we underestimated was the way sci-fi is perceived today is that it's inherently metaphorical. And everyone who watches these episodes, and it may be because of Black Mirror or for something else, they come in going, oh, is this a metaphor for terrorism? Is this a metaphor for technology? Is this that's their opening gambit, is that's how they're seeing sci-fi now. And I did not know that as hard as I sort of know it now. That was a surprise to me.
Yeah. Well, and it's something, and our episode plays with, it presents as if it's any number of those things. And so people have, there's a lot of reason that people make that, leap to that conclusion with our episode, obviously. But not to, whatever, go watch it. Make your own decision.
5 minutes.
That's it. We're done. Maybe we don't need to do an extra episode.
We did it. Also, two things about that. We'll move on from this self-aggrandizing section of the episode. Mm-hmm. We would love to interact with you more on Twitter and Instagram. Instagram allows for longer things. I swear we'll respond. Yeah. We want to know. We don't have accurate counts of who listens because of the way the metrics work on various platforms, but we'd love to know. We'd love to interact with you. Please reach out. We just sit around and we refresh our Twitter. That's what we do.
Especially now.
Yeah, that's all we do.
You're still in that window, people.
Yeah, please get to us. Okay, Big Trouble in Little China.
Well, and I mean, now, the funny thing is, what I'm afraid is going to happen here is that we're going to become the people that I now have issues with, which is like, this is a movie about a white guy who goes into a Chinese-American, you know, neighborhood or whatever, part of town, and winds up a key player within a kind of white director, director and white writers.
Very nervous about this.
Fantasy.
Yep.
Now, we're placing this into its historical context. Comes out in the 80s. This movie gets a lot of credit from a lot of people for being a reach out to the kinds of Hong Kong-oriented action films.
And they cast mostly the actors who were in those films.
Who were coming out in the 60s, 70s, you know, early 80s. You know, and so John Carpenter obviously liked those movies and wanted to do a homage to those or a riff on those and bring in kind of an American sensibility. So, you know, I remember not so very long ago, maybe I probably haven't seen this movie in maybe 10 years.
The same.
But I love it. I loved it. And it's so funny and it's so crazy and Kurt Russell's so amazing. So like my hope is that it's wonderful and you can kind of forgive certain, you know, racial trespasses. But my terror is that you can't, and that it will still be funny. It will still be good. There's going to be some things that make it uncomfortable. That's what I'm worried about.
You have said everything almost to the word that I wanted to say. That's okay. Great. I completely agree with everything you're saying. My honest prediction is that I don't think it will fall, just because of what the plot sort of actually is and the fact that they, you know, 80% of the cast is, you know, are actors from these other films in Hong Kong and in China. They are, if memory serves, there's no, you know, short circuit brown face happening, I don't think.
Well, the one exception to that is that I think Kim Cattrall is supposed to be like half or fully Chinese.
So
there's something weird about that.
Okay, well, I'll have to check that out.
By Kim Cattrall on our show.
Go ahead. She's so right. She's so white. I didn't remember that was a thing.
Like, I mean, I could be wrong about that, but she's involved somehow. I thought that it was. I could be wrong. I could be totally wrong about that.
I definitely remember her in the film. I did not remember she was supposed to be half Asian.
Well, although, maybe she's not.
We'll find out. So anyway, I expect.
It's a good thing about this show is that we go watch the movies.
Yeah.
And then we come back and we tell you what's what.
I was worried about the same things Kaylin is expressing here, but my honest prediction is that I think a lot of that will probably feel fine, with the exception of, I bet, 7 to 10 dumb jokes that feel racially motivated or something weird about them. That's kind of what I guess will happen.
Yeah.
I also think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but is this not a Gary Goldman script?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a Philip K. Dick tie there for us to
make. Yeah. That's his name, Gary Goldman.
Right?
Yeah. He wrote
Total Recall.
He wrote Total Recall. He wrote this. I've met him. I know him as a guy. That's all there is to say about that.
Mm-hmm. In any case, Philip K. Dick tie is all I'm saying. We're tying the first half of the episode to the second half of the episode here. No, I'm excited. John Carpenter, have we done any?
We did The Thing.
The Thing, of course.
We did The Thing, and I'm excited to talk about John Carpenter. Here, can I say this? I think I must have said, I probably said this during The Thing. I'll just repeat it.
Please.
I feel really weird about John Carpenter because I like him. I like him. I think he's a cool director to have existed. And he's made some movies that I really love. I do not really buy this idea that he is one of our great all-time filmmakers. And it feels like part of the sort of nostalgic evaluation of his work is, no, he's a master filmmaker.
Do you know what
I think
don't that
buy
is? No, I'm with you. I think that's part of the idea. This is maybe a loose tie. But, you know, the idea that James Gunn and these guys come out of the trauma school and that there's a resurrection of, I would call them B-movie auteurs, and that we rediscover some of them as sort of being masterful in certain ways. I think he was like one of the best of that group in a way. And I think that we attribute greatness to him that doesn't necessarily exist in a larger sphere.
Well, it's a funny thing because even as I sit here now, that is the overwhelming emotion I have about John Carpenter. But I could name three movies that I think are masterpieces. So, like, maybe, like, well, Halloween, Escape from New York, The Thing, probably, you know, and then I like a bunch of his other movies. I like They Live a lot. I like this movie a lot. I like, I fucking like In the Mouth of Madness. Like, he's made some, like, I've seen them all.
Do you feel like you regret trashing on him a little bit? Because
well,
now
no,
you
No, because this
him.
Is always where I'm at with him. Is, yeah. Like, I there are movies that I love and value, even though I don't think of them as, like, the great work, which is
Well, that's what this podcast is fucking about,
I guess,
man.
So.
It's things that we value
weird,
that may not
so
be great.
I feel so weird about it now.
Well, listen, we got trashed. We're going to trash John Carpenter. This is, you pay it forward. This is how criticism works.
I hope I just love it. And we will, speaking of Carpenter, what I do want to watch, if you haven't seen it, I assume you have, is the music video for the title song of Big Trouble in Little China.
I am almost sure I have.
Yeah, it's very important that we watch that.
Let's watch it. First of all, how many times have you seen this movie?
10.
Oh, wow.
Maybe less. Maybe 8.
4 for me. Three or 4.
I owned it. I've seen it a lot. I watched it on TV, and then I owned this. I owned the double disc DVD set that came out.
This fell in,
which was great.
This fell in my movie wheelhouse. I mean, I think you would be able to guess movies I've seen and movies I haven't. Hmm. This one falls in my wheelhouse. It's probably a 10 to 20 watcher in my wheelhouse, but only 3 or 4 in real life.
What?
Yeah. It seems like a movie I would have watched.
I don't understand
that. Well, because, you know, for example, Bloodsport I've seen 30 times.
So this, do you're, this feels you're like saying what I you like seen this more. As much as, you're not saying you like this as much as Bloodsport, but the,
no, I'm saying,
an objective viewer, watcher, listener would say that it's possible he likes that as
much
as Bloodsport.
Yeah, this is a four banana movie for me. All right, we're going to go watch it.
Okay.
Time for the medicine. Cheers!
This does what again, exactly?
Huge buzz. Oh, good. You can see things no one else can see. Do things no one else can do.
Real things?
As real as Lopan.
Hey, what more can a guy ask for?
Oh, the six demon bag.
Terrific, a six demon bag. Sensational. What's in it, Egg?
Wind, fire, all that kind of thing.
Here's to the Army and Navy and the battles they have won. As to America's colors, the colors that never run.
May the wings of liberty never lose a feather. Feel pretty good. And I'm not scared at all. I just feel kind of invincible.
Me too. I got a very positive attitude about this.
Good, me too.
Yeah.
Hey, two things.
Yep.
First thing, I was thinking the entire movie that I blew so fast in the intro past a piece of information that I feel that most people are not going to understand, and I want to acknowledge that this makes no sense.
Yeah.
When I said somebody slammed our episode, I named him Film Crit Hulk. And then I didn't.
But you said it
that.
Very seriously, yeah. Which was great.
So yeah. Yes.
I liked that part of the intro.
Well, I feel like I don't want to leave people in the lurch on that. There is a guy who is a human being.
His
who...
parents named him Film Crit. And it was Mr. and Mrs. Hulk. And he had to go into film criticism.
You did it.
That's it.
Two, it's a shame to me that we set up the podcast this way because there was no choice. But it's almost the thing that I feel least interested in discussing. So... Which is the racial issue or the sort of sensitivity versus insensitivity.
Let's do it first.
I'm afraid it's going to be a long conversation, but...
Okay, go ahead. Let's just get into it, and then we'll talk about the film. I have a couple things about this film that I think are... Not about the racial thing. I'll save my things.
Well, I don't know how to do it because I don't feel... I mean, it's like some of the things are so obviously bad or fine or innocuous... But I don't feel qualified to judge those things or hold the film accountable for certain things. Because to me, I guess to me as a sort of, you know, somebody who has no cultural background, I'm not Chinese in any way, nor do I know anything really about the culture or how this movie is representing that culture, feels like 90% bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
But for every egregiously bad thing it does one thing that's like fine or mm-hmm. cool or good or nice. So it feels like a 50-50 balance to me, and that 50-50 balance I would sort of be inclined to say like, ah, forget about it. Who cares? Let's just watch Big Trouble in Little China. Except that the entire film rests on the idea that Chinese people are just fucking magic. They're just fucking weird and magic.
Yeah.
And there's something that you kind of can't get away from that. What do I do? Like, do we say like this movie is problematic?
Well,
is that
wait,
the word that you
wait.
Have to suit?
I mean, yes, but let's talk. Let's combine the two things I wanted to talk about.
Great,
because one of them was this subject, and the other one was the level of self awareness that a movie has, and how that affects your enjoyment of it. I think this is a good example of a B movie. That's different from other B movies. I'm using B movie as a broad term here, but different than the other types of B movies we've watched, where there does in many parts there's a level of ironic self awareness and detachment that the film has that makes it really fun. And there's other times you think, I don't know if the film might think that's cool, and it plays with that line a little bit. And because you have a main American character doing a John Wayne impression, as you pointed out in the film, who drives a big rig, there's gun battles that are silly, and it's aping Americana to some extent in the film, and it's aping Asian culture, Chinese culture specifically, in to some extent. It makes the conversation very muddled, I think.
It's not really aping American culture. It's putting the ace up this movie's sleeve is that they put a American buffoon hero mm-hmm. in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. That's the secret genius that's going on here. And the super secret genius is that it's Kurt Russell.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Yeah, I don't know that doesn't exactly balance the scale on, you know...
I don't think it balances the scale, but I don't think you can have a conversation about the problematic elements without figuring out... I mean, this is part of that hipster racism conversation we were having before, but how aware the movie is of itself and how intentional it is and what it's doing.
If a movie knows, and we're just making up a bunch of bullshit, so let's just be silly about it, does that forgive the fact that it's just a fucking load of bullshit?
It doesn't forgive it, but it certainly has to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, I think so. I agree.
That's all I'm saying.
You know what I was thinking? And let's maybe a better way to do this is this will just be sprinkled throughout. We're just going to have this sort of this representation conversation throughout this entire conversation, this podcast. But to put it in context, and we should summarize the plot, I suppose. I kept thinking that this is like three movies. Mm-hmm. Some of which we've seen on the show, others we haven't. But the ones that I kept thinking of were Temple of Doom, mm-hmm. The Blues Brothers, mm-hmm. and Ghostbusters. I thought of those mm-hmm. three movies most prominently. And it's not as good as any one of those movies.
No.
But none of those movies are tasting other movies, like really, in a certain way. Like this movie's... The awesome thing about this film is that it's all those movies kind of badly, but the fact that it's all those movies kind of bad or kind of sloppy is awesome
mm-hmm.
and totally crazy and interesting and fun.
I had a really good time watching it this time. I didn't love it the way I think I did a decade or two decades ago.
This feels like a movie for young audiences.
Yeah.
I don't mean kids.
Yeah.
Early 20s or something.
I think I sort of aged out of it. Not that the movie didn't necessarily age well. I felt like, I've seen more movies now and I kind of get some of the shtick. And having worked on films a little bit now, you can tell what they're sort of throwing in for the sake of throwing it in versus things that are... And there are moments of sheer Kurt Russell brilliance like that are peppered throughout the whole movie. And those moments are sublime and amazing.
Yeah,
but there are so many moments you think, well, that's just a silly idea they had.
Also not... Let's be like totally honest, and I don't mean this to bury the film, and I don't want to do what I just accused someone else of doing to us, but like it feels, in this case, a little druggy... A little sloppy, mm-hmm. like maybe
which
there
can
are,
be great.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it is great in this movie, but other times it's like, are you kidding? Like
that's
for
the
real.
Thing. I mean, and
on that level, it feels like John Landis. It feels right. like that. Not like the way that this film is made is beneath even my estimation of what Carpenter can do.
Yeah,
like as a master of tone, and I know this movie's lighter than what he usually does, or at least what he's sort of famous for doing. But as a master of tone and editing and pace and look, I mean...
it's a mess. Here's what I'm obsessed by, though. And so Kalen made us watch this video afterwards, and I'm so glad he did because it is incredible. I had not actually seen it.
Yeah. It's the music video of John Carpenter and his band performing the title theme song from Big Trouble.
Big Trouble in Little China. So I feel like that video actually messed me up. Bad for having this conversation. And here's why. I was delighting in the conversation in my head throughout the movie of, did John Carpenter think that's funny or did he think it was dumb and that's why it was funny? I got a rabbit hole in my head because the movie defies explanation on that question. It's impossible. For example, in terms of the racial aspects of the film, there's the secondary lead to Kurt Russell speaks incredibly perfect English, and at one point gives a toast to the Navy in the military for reasons that are, I guess, comedically unknown. But twice in the movie, he does these sort of Asian malapropisms that were sort of in vogue in the 80s. One of them he says, I don't remember the two of them, he says, if this happens, we'll be dead doornails. Does John Carpenter think that's a funny joke, or is that what's happening? And the other one, I'll give you the other one, I'll let you answer this question. He says... This is a recurring thing. He goes, "Oh, nothing or double," instead of double or nothing.
Right.
What's happening? Is it supposed to be funny? What is happening in that moment?
I was really mystified watching this character. And this character, we have to say what the plot is.
Sure. But answer that
question. I will. But as a mechanism to get to that, because I can't really talk about the character without explaining what the story is. So the story is, I'm going to try to do this very quickly. Kurt Russell, he drives a truck which brings in livestock to Chinatown for the marketplace. And he likes to hang out when he comes every once in a while. He has a friend or two there in town. He likes to play cards and drink or gamble, rather. It's not cards. It's like dominoes or whatever. And he gets pulled because this friend, who this character that Travis is referencing, winds up losing to him and owes him money. Kurt Russell winds up tagging along with him on what begins this epic adventure through Chinatown, San Francisco Chinatown. What's happening?
I swear, you're gonna go down a hole.
So then, I mean, basically, a lot of magic bullshit happens. There's a bad guy who runs Chinatown from the shadows, who the people of Chinatown all know as Legend in some bizarre way.
David Lopez,
thousands of years old.
It is possibly the worst character exposition I've seen in a film, because they just sort of do it in bits and none of it really necessarily strings together that well.
No. Well, it wants Jack Burton, who's the Kurt Russell character, to be your vehicle into this crazy world, but he knows absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And there's this extraordinary depth of mythology that you need to know to understand what's going on. So I think the movie is having fun with this on some level, yes. Although it's dizzying
this is the question
ultimately
numbing. We need to ask ourselves.
Yeah, is that they just keep saying, oh, here's what's going on, blah, 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 blah. Got it? No.
It does get funny. And yeah. and there are sections of that exposition that the movie's like clearly aware, I would say, are funny. But other ones that don't seem to be.
But, and here's what I was going to say, the guy who has to do 75% of this exposition is the friend,
yeah,
who is a local to Chinatown, who does, he has a perfect English accent. There's no trace that he was ever born outside of the United States, probably wasn't. And yet he does exhibit some of these malapropisms. Not one time did I feel like he was in on some sort of meta joke about what kind of film they were making, at least in his performance. Yeah. And the fact that Kurt Russell is made me feel weird.
And Kim Cattrall is.
Yeah, I guess. I guess she is. I mean, yeah. She's obviously doing something ridiculous.
She's doing the shtick.
Yeah.
You know?
And this guy never is doing any
shtick. But for the character, I don't know, man. I'm torn on that because there's a version of this where he's totally in on the game and also does the same performance. Because that movie having a straight man sidekick is kind of like structurally okay to me. It just doesn't work necessarily here, but I can see him making that choice and being fully aware of
it. I don't know. I mean, again, I have no idea what the process was and how he geared his performance. But he's also not a gifted actor. And so, you know, he's just saying this stuff very earnestly, very quickly in order to move the movie along. And he's obviously a capable martial artist, which is, I'm sure, part of the reason he got the gig.
He does so many back handsprings in this film.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
So it's just a weird thing where, like, this guy is not holding up the joke, and I don't know if that's because John Carpenter didn't care enough to, like, push that, or the rigor of that was not really their agenda. Like, it just seems like they're kind of fucking around, and this guy's, like,
doing it.
He's trying to do it, yeah. You know? And it's it's not really clicking.
Caitlin neglected to mention there is a really confusing... It's a movie that's half bookended. It has a weird intro,
which I read was studio mandated.
Tell me about that, because I want to know what the fuck was going on.
They said, according to something I read, which who knows, you know, this stuff gets filtered down, that they didn't see obviously Kurt Russell as heroic enough in the film, and which obviously is by design as far as what Kurt Russell and John Carpenter are doing, and so they thought, well, let's put this little intro here to try to boost him up.
That's
so that when you meet
incredible
him, you know that's the hero, you know?
Oh, I love that note. Yeah. That's terrible. The movie starts with...
it's a fine scene, actually. But it's
a good scene, but if you think about it in terms of the film, it's a bad scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's the bus driver / magician. I'll just leave that there.
Sorcerer.
It's the bus driver.
His name is Egg Shen.
Yeah. And he's talking to his lawyer after all this has gone down. So it's a sort of post-movie scene.
Talking to a white lawyer... And the white lawyer's like, you gotta help me. Like, you blew up Chinatown. Somebody blew up
with
Chinatown.
Green fireballs.
The green fireball.
And basically, he just says, Jack Burton is a hero. But then he goes, also, magic is real. And he makes some lightning in between his hands. And then now we're into the film.
And you're supposed to be like, here we go.
It's such a crazy scene.
Also, not to jump to the end, but when you see how Jack Burton is a hero, like, that scene is ludicrous.
Well, it's so great. And what makes him great is he's so clearly, and this is a famous scene, so you guys remember this, but in the main climactic battle, Jack Burton knocks himself out, and he's is out for 50% of it. That is the film. Like, that is what they're doing.
Well, you know what, though? I mean, that is, yes, that is famous in terms of subversion of heroics or whatever in an American film. It didn't hit me as hard this time.
Same.
To be honest.
Same. Actually, same.
Yeah, I was sort of like, okay. Like, that's funny, but he's not really out. It's not really subversive
because
he gets up. He gets back into it. He actually does kill the bad guy. It's like,
I would have bet you money before watching this again that he was unconscious the entire battle.
Yeah.
That's what the culture and movie culture has told me happened in that scene.
Right.
And it's what I have come to remember. He's down for a second.
Yeah.
He gets up. He fights. He kills a bad guy.
Yeah.
He kills another bad guy.
Exactly. It's a great gag. I mean, it's, again, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say it's not well done.
It's not a great gag.
But it's a good idea. I mean, it's a great idea.
No, it's a great idea.
Yeah, and it's but a lot of this movie is like that. They have like these sort of brilliant subversive ideas that like his somehow hit like the fucking hit. Like, here's why I kept mentioning those three movies. Temple of Doom is made by a whiz kid genius, and visually it is always incredible. Its timing of action and its balance of, let's say, gags and drama, you know, action and stuff, I find brilliant. A lot of people said it kind of shit on Temple of Doom, and it has its issues, no doubt, in terms of representation, of course. But mostly I think it's like one of the greatest made things because it's so incredibly, what's the word I want to say? Like, it's like Spielberg is just a phenom. Like, he just can't, everything he does is so incredibly perfectly
and
delivered.
So tonally perfect.
Perfect. I mean, visually it's just extraordinary. And I know this is like at a lower budget or whatever. Carpenter's not, he just can't do it. And so you see him going for exactly that tonally. Like, there's this gag in the film, which has this long belabored buildup and this horrible execution where Jack Burton has led like the good guys through a room, and there's one door, and he's like, all right, I'm going to open this door, and it's going to be smooth sailing, and we are going to run through, and I'm going to lead the way, and you're all going to follow me. Got it? And they're like, we got it. And he opens the door, and it takes a minute to realize there's a lot of bad guys on the other side of the door.
Immobile.
And then he still. Then he closes the door, and he turns around, and he's like, I think we might be trapped. It's just horribly executed. Mm-hmm. Visual gag that you know very familiar from Spielberg. Like, Spielberg invented this kind of gag delivery, you know, within the context of action heroics. It's pure Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Or Han Solo, even, in some ways, you know. And so Carpenter can't do that. Okay, so he's not good at that, but there's a lot of that in it. What was the other one I said?
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, that's the other one, which is Ghostbusters doesn't exactly kill you with its action, but its timing is brilliant at all times. And the pace of the story is brilliant at all times. It's a beautifully paced comedy. And every punchline nails it. This one,
no.
They miss their punchlines. The timing is always off in a funny way. Yeah. Not always, but like often off.
There's a couple gags that land, but yes.
Yeah, totally. Yes. But there's a lot of lines that are just like, they just hang there. Like, it doesn't, like, what is the thing? There was some line that we both remarked on where Kurt Russell has a line that just doesn't work, and they hold it forever.
Oh, right. And they show like five reaction shots to it.
Yeah, and it's terrible. And so it's like, okay, so it doesn't, so, but it lives in the same sort of comedy action magical world as Ghostbusters. Also, conceptually, Ghostbusters, about ghosts. Big Trouble in Little China, about Chinese people. So it's also off the mark as far as that goes. And then Blues Brothers has this manic energy that is constantly propelling it. And it's a certain absurdism. It's a certain freneticism that this movie sometimes gets a hold of, but then it fucking stops dead sometimes.
You can tell it goes right off the rails the first time I try. The first moment to me that it's Blues Brothers-esque, it's not really a car chase sequence or anything, but there's this gun battle that erupts in the middle of the street. and our two heroes are stuck in a 18-wheeler cab, basically just the cab of it, in an alleyway, and there's this battle happening around them, and it's a standoff, and then it becomes a gun battle, and it's supposed to, I think, click into like some next gear and be fun and frenetic and crazy, and it's just not. It's just a bunch of dudes, shots of dudes firing guns.
And they're also, this whole sequence, which has like three action scenes within one, is also anchored, sort of, by Kurt Russell and his friend sitting in the bed of a truck watching it all go down. And it's very weird how removed from the drama. You don't know who they are.
Well, first, also, you don't the shots never connect them.
Right.
It always cuts to the inside of the cab and then to the battle. Right. And I kept thinking, this was such a weird directorial choice that you don't connect your heroes to the scene.
At all.
At all.
They're not in peril.
No.
They're just sitting there.
Even visually, they're not connected.
And
yeah,
the other thing about that, and this sequence it's a little bit famous, too. By the way, I do want to say, I liked it. I liked watching this movie, and
I wasn't bored. I had a good time.
But all of these flaws really stuck out to me this time, and I don't know if it's because it's how we set up our viewing experience or whatever, but the other thing about that sequence, which is the first big display of martial arts, of kung fu and stuff, and some of it's really cool. Some of it's pretty awesome, and like, I love the guys in the sort of big straw hats riding down the bolts of lightning and stuff. Like, there's some really great shit. But there's this one thing in there, this convention, which is from Hong Kong action films. I'm sure this is where Carpenter got it. He was watching Hong Kong kung fu action movies. And it's that if you've seen those movies or if you've seen this film, you know what I'm talking about. They will put a dummy in the immediate foreground, mm-hmm. and then the somebody will punch it in the head. Mm-hmm. And it'll look not like a human being is getting hit in the head, but it'll look like a dummy, basically a stuffed dummy is getting hit. And it's a really sort of in some ways jarring and kind of shocking action image, because it looks like that thing, whatever that is, which we thought was a head, is getting hit so hard that it's almost crumpling in the frame. And they do this to limbs, they do this to legs and arms and stuff. And it is something you didn't see in Western action movies, because it's a very Eastern idea. It's this sort of like, you know, surreal, almost brutality. So Carpenter gets a lot of credit for putting this in a movie, period. It's just like it's in the film. He put that, you know, into a mainstream context, in a Western mainstream context. However, he does it about 5 million times, and it's totally inartful.
Yeah.
It is terrible.
I will say the thing that martial arts films, of which I am a fan, aficionado, every good fight sequence doesn't just have badass shit in it. It has a pace. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a story to the fight scene. Like,
yeah,
moves mean certain things. The way the tide turns is important. The way you shoot it, all that is important. John Carpenter understands none of that. Like, right. There's no. It's just a. You could take a shot or a sequence of shots from the end of the fight, put them in the beginning. Doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
They're just sort of mashed together. And there's some cool stuff in there. Like, there's some there's some good moves and some good things going on. But they get boring because there's no story.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really drove me crazy. A lot of these fight scenes, and I like fight scenes. I really like them. They feel boring and dull because they're not narratively driven. They're not cut as fight scenes.
The engagement in the action, which the movie obviously knows because it deals with this later by knocking out Jack Burton, is truly hampered by the fact that your main character is someone who has no fucking clue what's happening. Yeah. No relation to it. No particular investment in it. The only investment he ever even has across the entire movie is that he has basically kind of a crush on Kim Cattrall.
Who doesn't play an Asian woman, but confusingly.
Yes, I messed that up. Yeah. But
relevant.
tell him how that works.
So
this is part of the plot.
Though. And this feels, I'm stymied by this. So the idea is that, what is Jack Burton's friend's name? Do we remember his
name? I don't remember. The,
look it up. Yeah, the sidekick guy. Kaelin will tell us the name in a second. They have to go to the airport after losing the money. So in this character's life, he stays up all night gambling the night before he meets his fiance at the airport for reasons that are completely confusing.
That's right. So, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know why he decided to do that.
He's just like, I gotta go pick up my fiance.
By the way, I have to go pick up the most beautiful woman in the world. She's my fiance. Okay. So Jack Burton's like, cool, we'll go do that.
Wang Chi.
All right. So Jack and Wang go down to the airport, and there's a woman who she's Chinese with green eyes. She's very rare, and Wang makes a big point of explaining this. And then Kim Cattrall is also at the airport.
And can I say, part of the reason I messed this up is because the woman who plays the girl from Taipei, who's just fresh off the boat Chinese,
is
clearly at least half white.
Yeah.
And yes,
looks
indeed.
A lot like Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, and she just looks utterly westernized. And she, in fact, is born in America, Playboy model who got the gig because, you know, whatever.
She's exotic looking.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the
vaguely exotic, safely exotic, which is uncomfortable.
Safely exotic. That's right.
Hot exotic.
Yeah, that's right. So it ends up being she ends up getting kidnapped by a gang that works with David Lopin because he has been. For I guess 2,300 years roughly, if you track the math of this story.
At one time they identify his age as something BC, and I was like, what the fuck?
Like 272 BC something. The movie doesn't care, so we don't either, honestly. Totally. No one gives a shit. But he's become this ephemeral spirit, and then sometimes he's an old man, you remember this, he's in a wheelchair and he does this like cackly little voice. And then sometimes he can transform himself into sort of a spirit David Lopin. And floats around. But he wants to become whole again, and the way he becomes whole is by marrying an Asian woman with green eyes. Yes. Is what we're told. We're told Chinese girl, green eyes. And then, at a certain point, he kidnaps... Well, he doesn't kidnap. Harry and the Hendersons character kidnaps Kim Cattrall. then he finds...
Bigfoot from Harry and the Hendersons.
It'd be really weird.
Shows up.
Yeah, we'll get into that, I guess. Or maybe we've done it now. And he says, "Oh, you have green eyes too. I'll also marry you." And then Caleb and I were both confused.
But you are also they've. It's not like this is This is there's a lot of shit that's said in passing. This ain't one of them. Like they very explicitly say it's crazy rare to find a Chinese girl with green eyes.
It never happens,
which makes it very hard for him to fulfill this like debt that he owes to some god ghost emperor slash who fucking knows what.
That's not important.
So and so they're like it's a really big crazy deal that they finally found one, and he's tried before and it hasn't worked out. So it's a huge and important point that it's rare, huge and important. So then, like Travis says, Kim Cattrall just sort of bungles her way into his world. And he's like, whoa, like, score. She's got green eyes, too. Forget all that shit about rare. Any green-eyed girl will do. I'm going to marry her, too.
And here's the thing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I want to know what you were going
to
say.
I was going to say, from the screenwriting perspective, an extremely easy problem to solve.
Yeah.
Extremely easy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why they didn't do that.
They didn't because this feels like it was added very, very late in the process to me. And I don't know at all what the history is, but... She doesn't factor. Like, what's amazing, and there's this big ritual, whatever. So they just needed, I would bet money that she only exists, period. Because they were like, well, what the fuck does this hero care about Chinese people? Like, you're expecting us to say he invests in all of this bullshit because he's friends with a Chinese guy? No way.
You mean Kim Cattrall?
Yes.
Of course.
So they created her. Yeah. I would say it feels relatively late
in the screenwriting process.
Yeah, in the screenwriting process. Yeah. And so she winds up in this ceremony, totally irrelevant, because she's saved and it doesn't change one thing about the guy's master plan at all. So she's just there. She's just there, just like, well, we need something to get this guy to give a shit. Give him a hot girl, hot blonde girl.
Yeah, but why not do... I mean, there's a lot of qualities that two women could share that are rare.
Right.
I just feel like that's an easy... puzzle.
Absolutely.
So I'm but they'd
already
find,
they'd already laid the I mean again I don't want to just accuse people of laziness or whatever
but this had to have been decided pre-filming. It's in the script phase.
Yeah.
So take an extra hour. That's all I'm saying. It's not a major script
revision.
Why
take an extra hour when there's another sweet line of cocaine that needs snorting? That's what I say.
Why? I mean, John Carpenter can't take time to comb his hair for the music video, so why the fuck would he take time to figure out a better solution to this very non-intractable problem? You just solve it, John.
But it's more fundamental
than Gary, I guess. What does Gary Goldman do?
Well, you know what's funny about that? Because I actually didn't do much of this. I don't want to make it sound like I was researching the whole film. I only did this I read like one Wikipedia article, whatever. Their script, the Goldman and his partner's script, was set in the 1800s. It's a Western.
What?
Yeah. Their script.
Did it involve Chinese people?
Yes.
In like the Old West?
Yes. Oh. And
you see, yest.
Yest.
And in the West, yes.
Yes. Kurt Russell, whatever the hero, was a gunslinger guy.
Is that why he's doing John Wayne in this movie?
Maybe.
Interesting. That's cool.
And so W.D. Richter, the guy who wrote like Buckaroo Banzai and shit, he came along and he was like, "Oh, here's what you gotta do. Update this, you know."
Let's talk about Kurt Russell for a second,
please.
That guy. Do you know? I mean, so many ways to go here. I wonder if this movie. I was trying to think of other actors who could make this movie watchable in the way that Kurt Russell does. I don't know that I can come up with them. It's this beautiful, blustering, swaggering performance of it's just pure Kurt Russell. Just him, like, being a overconfident buffoon, but not in a way that feels cloying or dumb. It feels so funny to me and so good. And even the moments that are clearly dumb lines and clearly dumb jokes, he just sells them. He just goes for it.
By the way, that thing that I said, that guy did not write Buckaroo Banzai. That's somebody totally different. This guy didn't do anything good.
Okay.
Forget about it.
All right.
No.
I loved it. I loved Kurt Russell in this movie. This movie is worth watching. And the movie's not as good as I remember it being. Kurt Russell, for the most part, is as good as I remember him being.
Absolutely. And he, you know, it's funny. I was trying to put myself in the shoes of like 1986 audience and to go this movie to come out. And I know that Kurt Russell, you know, you've got his history as a Disney boy, you know, whatever, and he's done Escape from New York with Carpenter. I don't know if they've done The Thing yet. They had done The Thing. They'd already done this is the third time they're up at bat. Thing's not a hit, whatever. And I guess that there have been movies at this time where he's being funny, but, like, there's nothing – I can't think of anything that would prepare them for what he's doing here. And now it's one of those things where in the benefit of a long career – it all is fine. Like, it's not uncomfortable that he's being so hilarious. Mm. It's just like, oh, man, I fucking love Kurt Russell. I'm so used to him and all the funny stuff he can do and all the cool stuff he can do. And that makes this kind of performance go slightly against the norm and be delightful and be super hilarious. But it's weird when a movie – like obviously they knew Kurt Russell was funny and he knew he was funny and he knew he was being funny. But I don't really blame an audience for not getting it, I guess.
Oh, we should say this movie, if I'm not mistaken, was not a hit.
No, not a hit. Yeah. Not a hit. And came out in the wake of, I almost said this in the intro, but came out not long after. It was like in competition with The Golden Child, which is this year.
That's interesting.
Very, right?
And so not identical, but a related plot.
Yeah, it's like Chinese mysticism. Yeah, yeah, and they were like aware of each other, and so they tried to crank Big Trouble through the machine in order to get out fast, in order to beat Golden Child. They ultimately, I think, did not beat Golden Child, and they were also just like the studio was like, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah, what is this thing? I remain confused. I want to raise this initial point again because I don't think it got its due. It's due in court. It's due date in court. It's hearing in court.
Yeah,
you know, whatever. I don't understand when the movie's aware of itself and when it's not. And I hate to harp on this point, but there are so many dud jokes, and there's so many jokes that are intentional duds. Like the difference between an intentional dad joke and a dumb dad joke. It's like I think your intent is very important in that delivery and what you know is dumb or funny about that. And I don't know that the movie's always clear it sort of bothers me.
That actually doesn't bother me. That doesn't bother me because I think that the spirit is – I don't know how to put this. I don't know who exactly to compare this to, but it's a little anarchic. It's a little bit like the spirit of not caring which one is fun to me. And like I'll give you an example. There's a scene in the movie that I will defend, even though it's like indefensible in certain ways, where there's this gag where, for whatever reason, you can imagine it, if you've seen it, you know it, Kurt Russell's in a wheelchair that's rolling down a ramp. And he finally, it rolls all the way down, it crashes into a little stone, you know, outcropping or whatever, and he gets stuck over a hole. So he's hanging kind of over a hole in this wheelchair. And he's balanced or whatever, caught on, I don't even really know what. So he does this great display of strength to tip himself and pull himself back up on the wheelchair so as to not tip over into the pit. And then he like wheels forward inch by inch, clearly in
safe.
The clear.
Very safe.
Very safe. Yeah, yeah. All you'd have to do is just, like, easily, not even a feat of strength,
roll up.
Roll forward. Yeah. It's a flat surface.
Yeah.
And yet he does this thing where he very perilously quickly stands up and with his legs knocks the wheelchair backwards into the pit to make it seem totally perilous. It's absolutely not perilous. It's not even like the joke is about him thinking he was in danger and not being.
It's a movie joke.
It's not even a joke.
It's a joke. I think
what's the joke?
I think Kurt Russell's making a joke.
What's the joke?
That the idea is that he's now safe and he's acting like he's still in danger. It's perfectly in character. I think it's Kurt Russell the actor going like, you know, it's gonna be funny.
Kurt Russell the actor.
Yeah.
Not the character.
No. Kurt Russell the actor, not Jack Burton.
Saying it would be funny if
I did this.
Not as the character or just as Kurt Russell.
Wait, what?
Are you saying that it would be funny if Jack Burton the character did this?
Kurt Russell was saying that,
but
that's my theory. Because
I'm not sure I buy it, but yeah. That might be true. The way it's shot, that doesn't work.
I don't know if John Carpenter was in on the joke. I wrestle with that scene. I'm down a rabbit hole on this, man, because there's a lot of times I think Kurt Russell gets the joke and John Carpenter doesn't.
But you can't say that because you know logically.
I know it's impossible.
The way that a film is made.
I know that's impossible.
They watched that a million times.
I know that's impossible. And yet the movie, that's a perfect scene to illustrate.
That's what I'm saying. The movie's like, who fucking cares? It's funny. They're like, who cares? That's funny. I'm laughing. That's funny.
Yeah, but
therefore the end.
That's
the kind of spirit that the movie brings to
it. I've decided, though, that Kurt Russell has a better sense of humor than John Carpenter, and they are at odds with each other in the performance of this character.
But I don't think they're at odds. They're just funny.
Not combative, necessarily. I don't mean, like, let's do it this way. I mean, I think that there's jokes in there that when they happened on set, that Kurt Russell knew it was funny, and John Carpenter was like, do whatever you want. That's fine.
Let's think about this, really. Let's really think about
this. Okay.
Carpenter, one of two things happened. Either Carpenter only shot that master shot. That's all he shot. And he was like, I don't care. that's the shot. We're using it.
Yeah, it's
and
cool.
It's funny.
We lost the wheelchair.
Fuck you all.
The wheelchair's broken now.
Or he shot also a close-up. Would have been a normal thing to do. That's probably what happened. That's probably covered in a way mm-hmm. where they could play the danger. And in the editing room, he decided, nah, let's just fucking show this thing that's not perilous and people will fucking deal with it and they'll laugh.
I bet you.
And they didn't laugh because that's ridiculous.
No, it's funny.
But I laughed, you know.
I want to see the script. I want to know what it says in the script. But I think Kurt Russell was like, you know, it'd be funny is this thing. And John Carpenter
No, no way in the script is it he lifts himself up and then casually rolls forward, gets out of the wheelchair and is like, I made it.
No, what I wonder in the script is he barely gets out and basically leaps out as the chair falls.
That is exactly.
And they get to set. And they go, how do we do that? We can't do that. That doesn't make any sense. Like, actually, with the laws of physics, you can't do that.
The laws of physics, you should talk about the fucking gauntlet. The rugby pole.
That drove me crazy. So I think Kurt Russell's like, I got a good idea. We'll just do it this way. And instead of being a perilous moment, it's a funny moment. And I think John Carpenter's like, well, whatever. Like, that's what I think happened. So I don't think it's written as a joke. I think Kurt Russell made it a joke, but I don't think anyone else did.
But
I'm telling you,
I'm telling you, like, movie magic is such that you don't shoot that way. You just don't. Like, that can't be the only... Carpenter's a fucking pro. That can't be the only shot he shot.
Yeah.
And that if... Just imagine that same exact thing in a medium shot or a close-up.
Yeah.
You've seen it. You see him getting to the edge. All you have to do is then cut to the wide and the thing falls down. Like, you're in tight. He stands up. You cut to the wide shot. The thing falls down the thing. And it's like, wow, close call.
But
here's
my story of that. I have an answer to that.
Uh-huh.
They do it on set. And it's Kurt Russell's idea. Everyone fucking goes gonzo for it. People are like, that was so funny. John Carpenter's like looking around, like fake laughing, like, yeah, it's funny. We're going to use it. We're going to use that thing. It's going to be great.
There's no way.
There's so many moments in this film where I think, thank God Kurt Russell's here. I'm not confident.
Well,
but here's the thing. I'm not sure. I don't know if John Carpenter gets all the jokes. He might. I don't think he does.
The other funny thing about this movie is, there's extraordinary beauty and care in certain things. In some of the makeup, creature, and effects design,
yeah.
Awesome. I mean, there's clearly a lot of effort and creativity going on there in the design of some of these oddball and inexplicable creatures, but nevertheless, like, and you could just chalk that up to like whoever was doing the effects and the makeup, they were on their shit. Like, they wanted to make some really beautiful stuff, and Carpenter wasn't going to stop them from making great stuff. But I don't know that I believe that, because some of the setup, some of the sets, some of the execution of certain things is excellent and is at him at his best. And so I don't know where that line is.
It's very hard. It's very perplexing. There's also Kalen's mentioned this, but a haphazard use of magic. There's a moment they go under the building, and they're in a mystical land full of, you know, bridges and fog. And then a creature comes out of the wall and eats a person and goes back in. And that's it. That's just it.
A creature with no origin story or explication living under San Francisco Chinatown. Who knows?
Not even related in design to anything else. It's completely like, well, you know, someone go design that.
Well, and you know the answer to this. Why does that work?
This is funny.
Yeah, and because Kurt Russell says, "What the fuck was that?" And they're like, "Move on."
Yeah.
That's the joke. Like, that's what's funny. Is like, again, and to me it comes down on some level to, you know, there's a sense that these guys feel a certain carte blanche because, like, who the fuck knows about Chinese shit? Nobody.
Yeah, they got monster bug creatures.
Yeah, like, who knows? There's some. Yeah, they probably have some kind of kooky werewolf.
Yeah.
Who cares? Jesus. Like, let's just make it.
But don't you think in a way that the Chinese angle is just the way in, and then it becomes
Of course it is, but that's very – that's deeply insensitive.
Yeah, of course. But I think that they're
– they just want to make some magic crazy shit. I get it.
Their thought process in the 80s was –
And know, also, less it's developed in some ways, you know what it's like? It's a pretty decent replication of what it must be like for John Carpenter when he watches Hong Kong movies, which is like, he's like, this is crazy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Where'd that guy come from?
Yeah. Like, they're all over the place. I can't understand a thing. I don't know what's going on, but I like it. I want to put this in a movie, and I want to do it my way. So, like, and that's like, I actually don't even mean that as a negative. Like, you know, what are you going to do? Especially when this stuff was not necessarily that prevalent in Western culture. He saw some and he was like, that's crazy. I bet I could do something like that.
Yeah, it's weird because there's either not enough or too much magic and creatures and stuff. There's only like three creatures. Is that right?
Yeah.
There's three creatures for a total screen time of a minute and a half.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Creatures, by the way. Yeah. Like, let's explain. Like,
one's Bigfoot with a crazy face.
Yeah, and one is a weird floating ball eyeball. With lots of eyeballs.
Yeah. Which you probably remember. I had forgotten I remembered it, but when it came on, I was like, oh, this fucking thing was haunting me.
Right, and one is a creature that pops out of the wall. And now the other thing is that the makeup effects don't stop there because they kind of blend. Again, this is uncomfortable. They kind of blend into who the Chinese people are. Sometimes they can become creatures, like when a guy blows up his body, and he's basically the same rubber bullshit, I mean in a cool way, as those creatures, and he's like, steam comes out his ears and he blows up for no reason.
I mean, no reason.
And is that an attack? Lopan, the bad guy, can sometimes have a glowing skull head.
I like that effect.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's good. That's the best one in the movie, I think.
But it's like, they're so foreign that it's like, who cares?
When,
like,
the
whatever.
Guy, yeah, I get that. When the guy blows up his head, blows up his body, is he sad, or is that an attack strategy? Or is he just pissed that his dad...
Well,
he blows
his body up to try to bring the whole thing down on them.
I think that was a strategy.
It's not well photographed or
it's extraordinarily unclear.
Yeah. He blows himself up, his guts spill all over the place, weirdly green
and
guts.
And then the ceiling
falls down.
But in a different spot than he blew up.
Yeah.
Who cares? Anyway, I think watch it. I say that. It's fine. It's not as good as you remember it being, is what I'll say.
Yes.
You probably liked this film, and you will still enjoy it.
Yes.
But don't, like, bring all your friends to go see to the cemetery.
Well,
they won't
know,
think it's as
here's
funny.
The thing, though. You know, I was thinking a lot about, like, the best context. Like, what's the best context for this movie?
This movie, actually, if you live in L.A., is playing outside at a big event, and I thought about going. Because I bet it is more fun with the
crowd. Yeah. They're playing at the Vista. They're playing at the Vista Midnights because they did three Indiana Jones and then they did this. Isn't that funny? Isn't that interesting?
Did I ever tell you, side note, when I lived in Scotland, there was a theater that played one movie a week. And then on Friday nights at midnight, they'd play one old film every week. Mm-hmm. And so you go, they had one screen and it was great. And it was a two levels, at a balcony and a lower level. It sat probably 400 or something. So the whole town would go if there's a big movie. So they did Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Mm-hmm. And everyone showed up and we all went and it was packed. And there was a guy, this old Scottish man. He was a townie. He wasn't part of the university. St. Andrews University has three streets. It is a big townie sort of college kid rivalry there. This old Scottish guy dressed like Indiana Jones. He had a whip and they did not take it from him. They let him in with the whip and he had a jacket and he had a hat. And every time Indiana Jones in the film pulled out his whip, this man was in the front row of the balcony. He'd stand up and go, "Hyah!" And he'd snap the whip above the audience. And it was the fucking best thing that's ever happened.
Wow.
I freaked out. And then after that, I just thought, I love this guy. It was great. He must have snapped the whip, 15 times.
Jesus Christ. Well, that's very dangerous, but I like it.
What a fella.
I wanted to say this.
Yes.
I was trying to think about, this is going to be nostalgia showing in a bad way, I am sure. But I was like, what's the best possible context? It might be in a theater with a lot of people who are fans of the film, getting into it, laughing. That's probably the best possible atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say second best is you're young, you're in high school, and you can rent this movie from the video store with like three other movies and watch a bunch of funny, cool, action-y movies if you're a film nerd or like wants to get drunk or whatever with their friends. That context is now gone, mm-hmm. And I don't think this movie exactly lives well in, let's say, own it or stream it, like pay money. Like, I don't know why, but it doesn't feel the same. It feels a little bit like the context for watching this movie, like what we just did, we bought it off Amazon or whatever, rented it, watched it. I don't know why, it just doesn't feel right for this film.
Yeah, its wackiness does need some sort of accompaniment or like, people around to...
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a B movie, and it should function in that way. And on that level, it's great. It's great. It's funny. It's fun. It's cool. It's a surprise. It's a little bit left of center, in terms of like what you expect.
Leave it on the shelf. Wait.
Leave it on the shelf. Although I will say, coming out of this, I don't feel any more convinced that Carpenter is like a godmaster filmmaker.
There's some really poorly shot sequences.
He can be really bad.
This movie is good, but he does not direct the sequence as well, with a couple exceptions.
Sometimes he does, yeah exactly. All right. Next week, or whatever.
Yeah. Stand by for the next episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where Kalen and I, we'll be looking at a movie that he's about to draw. Please also look at our Instagram, DYFMSuck, our Twitter, DYFMSuck. Please take a look, and you'll see this next movie illustrated on our Instagram account, thanks to Thomas James. Good job, Tommy. @goodjobtommy.
Anything else you want to say?
That's all I had to say.
We've done our shout outs. Go see watch our episode of Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams called Safe and Sound if you haven't watched it yet. I think we're done talking about that for now.
For now. Please communicate with us via social media.
Don't @FilmCritHulk. He's a good guy.
Oh, yeah, he's a fine guy. Oh, also, I just want to say, I tweeted this out from our account. I don't know if you saw it, but I stand by it. I do stand by Vegetable Festival. I've been thinking a lot about it, and fuck all you guys who disagree, because I legit stand by it.
I don't think they've been privy to this argument, but let's not rehash it here. Next week. I'm very excited about this poll. Jerry Maguire.
Oh, I was talking about this today.
Can't wait.
Today.
Yeah.
Well, I have a good guess for
it. Still lives with us.
All right.
See you next week.
Bye. See you later. Bye. Bye.